The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Vox.com, Best Money Ever Spent on a White Cane. BusinessWire.com has an article regarding the Guide Dogs educational video that was just dropped. Popular Science has an article about parasitic birds that select visually impaired hosts to raise their children. MacArthur Foundation has just named Joshua Miele, M-I-E-L-E, a fellow of the class of 2021. Apple Insider has an article on Apple removes Siri's features that visually impaired users need. Bleepy Computer has an article about Google Chrome fixes for zero-day hackers. So let's get started. The best $34.32 I ever spent. My white cane. As a blind person, it was a conscious investment in my own independence. By Kudsia Naki, Q-U-D-S-I-Y-A-N-A-Q-U-I. I touched down in Denver, made my way through the airport, and got an Uber to a restaurant a friend had recommended. I had made a reservation in advance, walked right in, and was seated at the bar. I enjoyed an entree and a cocktail and caught up on podcasts while I ate my meal. Later I paid my bill, then took another Uber to my hotel. This all sounds pretty mundane. As a 35-year-old professional, I had gone on a million business trips before, but as a newly minted, openly blind person, it was a huge first for me. Checking in with the hostess, ordering the dinner I selected in advance after perusing the menu online, and being just another patron amid the chatter and clinking of dishes in the hip, busy downtown spot, made me feel powerful and present in a way that was entirely new, and frankly, the meal was quite delicious. As I settled into my hotel room that night, I thought about the object that made this whole trip possible, my white cane. Wielding the cane in the airport, at the restaurant, and in the hotel made me feel powerful and in control. But I recalled a time when that was not the case. I remembered when pulling out the white cane filled me with shame. It was the symbol of my failure to be sighted. I was born with a genetic degenerative eye condition that meant the cells in my retina responsible for light perception were either severely damaged or non-functional. I was effectively night blind, but I had pretty good daytime vision, depth perception, and acuity. As a child and then a young adult, I could mostly fake it as a sighted person. With eyes that appeared to track the world around me and no white cane or guide dog to mark me as blind to sighted people, my disability was well hidden. And surrounded by a sighted family, classmates, and teachers, that's what I was encouraged to do. I went through life without interacting much at all with other blind people, except for the mobility instructors that my mom arranged for me through our state's blind services agency, starting when I was in elementary school. They would pull me out of regular classes during the day to train me on how to use a white cane. My pretty good daytime vision, however, made it hard for me to see the benefits of the cane, and I spent most of those sessions making sure none of my classmates saw me with this strange device. Whenever I practiced with the instructor, I felt awkward and somewhat like a fraud. I could still see well, and I feared people would think I was faking being blind. Still, I did absorb much of what these mobility instructors, some of whom were blind themselves, taught me. I learned different cane strokes, swiping across the ground in front of me or using the two-point touch to tap at shoulder-width intervals. I learned how to navigate stairs and avoid bumping into obstacles in my path. I mastered street crossings, listening carefully for parallel traffic as the signal that it was safe to cross. By middle school, I had the cane skills pretty much down pat. But even at that young age, I subconsciously understood ableism and loathed the idea that people who saw me with the cane would think I was weak, deserving of pity. Or worse, an amazing inspiration simply because I was able to move at all. At school, I tried to avoid things like dropping a pencil on the ground. As I'd feel around for my fallen writing implement, I would hear the jeers of the boys in my class as they laughed and called me blindy. At the time, I thought, how dare they lob this horrible slur at me? It made sense now, considering neither they nor I had learned anything in school about disability. I never saw characters that experienced the world like I did in the literature we read or the history we learned. My blindness was invisible to everyone, and I participated in the game of sweeping it under the rug. Those feelings persisted into my teenage years and young adulthood. In college, my cane remained tucked away, out of sight in my bag. The one time I tried to use it walking down Broadway in New York City, where I went to school, some kid yelled out, "Why is she using that? She's not blind." This instantly pulled me back into my shell of secrecy and shame, reacting to the dissonance created by my partial sight and use of the cane. It would be years before I tried displaying the outward trappings of my disability, instead of opting for the more discreet, albeit less convenient, approach of holding on to other people's arms for guidance when I couldn't see. I began to lose vision rapidly in my late 20s, and that loss defined how I navigated life. I set limits on where I would go, turned down social invitations, afraid to venture out by myself at night. Still, my desire to obscure what was happening to me was paramount, even above my own physical safety. It took some serious brushes with calamity, including falling into the train tracks at Penn Station because I wasn't using a cane and missed the edge of the platform, that led me to wake up and realize that if I didn't change my attitude, I could seriously harm myself or even lose my life. My denial of disability was starting to look more like a death wish. I didn't want my vision loss to be the end of me. I found a new mobility instructor as a free service through the State Commission for the Blind and learned to navigate New York City. For 1 hour every week, an extremely kind, patient woman walked beside me while I felt my way through subway stations and navigated intersections. Gradually, she started walking behind me, forcing me to feel more comfortable being seen alone with the cane. One day, she gave me an address to travel to on my own and said she would meet me there. That was the first time I walked the streets and rode the subway with my cane and felt completely fine about it. There was no twinge of shame or embarrassment. When I found my instructor at our designated meeting spot, I had a huge grin on my face. I learned bit by bit not to care who was looking at me or what they were saying. Once I began to tune all of that out, I started to understand how this 54-inch length of graphite was changing my orientation to the world. I could go anywhere at any time. I wasn't constrained by shame and fear. The cane I came to accept was my best tool to participate in the world on equal footing with my sighted peers. According to the 2018 National Health Interview Survey, an estimated 32.2 million adults in the U.S., or about 13% of the adult population, reported either having trouble seeing even with glasses or contact lenses, or being partially or completely blind. The way people deal with it varies. Some prefer to only walk with sighted assistance. Some use white canes. Others prefer guide dogs. Canes give you a lot of advance information when walking. You can feel bumps in the sidewalk, curbs, and abandoned scooters that people dump in the middle of the sidewalk. The cane offers a wealth of information in each swipe, and for me, this made it indispensable. Up until that point, I had relied on a series of free canes given me by various mobility instructors at various points in my life. When I moved to Washington, D.C. and started hanging out with more blind people, I discovered the world of cane variety. There are marshmallow tips, a big ball at the end of your cane that literally looks like a giant marshmallow, and pencil tips and roller tips. People even get cool bling for their canes, like sparkly charms with rhinestones that you can hang from the hand strap. Suddenly, I felt that my tattered, beat-up free cane from the New York State Commission for the Blind was just not up to par. So I invested in my first white cane. I chose a 59-inch graphite folding cane from Amputec with a marshmallow tip as recommended by another blind friend. It cost $34.32, and I was so excited when it arrived in its fresh plastic wrapping. This was the first time I had been able to pick out the cane I wanted. I selected the length and chose an accent color, a cheerful, bright pink strip at the bottom to complement the white body of the cane. By buying the cane with my own money and in consultation with other cane users, the experience of blindness was no longer a burden I bore alone. It was a cultural marker that bound me closer to a community I had begun to fall in love with. It was my first true investment into my identity as a blind person, an object that would unmistakably mark me as disabled, and I was proud and delighted. I felt incredible joy in joining the ranks of my blind friends, all of us forming a crowd of white canes and guide dogs. I now have multiple canes for all occasions and needs, and I swap between them like outfits in my closet. Gone are the days of hiding my cane away, folded in the depths of my purse. When it's in my hand, I feel seen. I'm unabashedly present in a world that perpetually wants to erase me and my disabled community. Now, wherever I'm going, that cane is coming with me, and I'm up for whatever solo adventure comes my way. Kutsiya Naki is a lawyer, disability justice activist, and host of the podcast Down to the Struts, about disability, design, and intersectionality. From BusinessWire.com, Guide Dogs for the Blind launches video to educate public transit agencies and operators on inclusion. Video also aims to create public awareness about guide dog team access. Posted September 20th, access to public transportation and rideshare services is a right for people who travel with a guide dog. That right is protected under federal and regional laws in both the United States and Canada. This video offers tips to help make access to transit a good experience for everyone. Dateline San Rafael, California, from Business Wire. As part of the National Guide Dog Month, Guide Dogs for the Blind, GDB, is launching a short animated video to help create a more respectful, safe, and inclusive public transportation experience for people who are blind or visually impaired and their guide dogs. The animated 2-minute video is aimed at transportation service providers and drivers. It includes tips on how to interact with guide dog teams with specific suggestions for rideshare drivers, such as verbally identifying themselves when picking up a guide dog team. The video also includes etiquette for members of the general public who may be taking a subway or bus with a guide dog team. The video includes other tips and etiquette for interacting with guide dog teams, such as treat someone who is blind with the same respect and dignity as you would anyone else. Talk directly to people, not their dogs. Act if someone needs assistance before giving it. Give clear verbal directions about where something is located. We believe everyone can move through the world safely and confidently, and that should include using public transportation, said Christine Benninger, President and CEO of Guide Dogs for the Blind. This video is another example of our commitment to empowering people who are blind or visually impaired, because we know that our communities are stronger when everyone is included. The video will be shared this month directly with transportation companies, guide dog user groups, and advocacy groups for people who are blind or visually impaired, and it will be distributed via GDB's website, guidedogs.com, YouTube, social media, transportation trade events, and various other online channels. The laws are in place that give people the right to travel with their guide dogs via public transportation. There is a lack of resources to educate public transit agencies and operators about how to create a safe and inclusive experience for guide dog teams. In creating the video, GDB hopes to fill this void and help transit agencies and operators feel better equipped to provide excellent service for all. About Guide Dogs for the Blind. Headquartered in San Rafael, California, Guide Dogs for the Blind, GDB, is the largest guide dog school in North America. It is a passionate community that prepares highly qualified guide dogs to empower individuals who are blind or visually impaired to move through the world more safely and confidently. More than 16,000 guide teams have graduated from GDB since it was founded in 1942. GDB not only improves mobility for its clients, but it also furthers inclusion and advocates for policy reforms that change how the world views blindness. All of GDB's services are provided free of charge, and it received no government funding. The organization was the subject of an award-winning 2018 documentary feature called Pick of the Litter, which was developed into a television docu-series by the same name that debuted in 2019 on Disney+. For more information, visit guidedogs.com or call 800-295-4050. Guide Dogs for the Blind's sister organization, Guide Dogs for the Blind International, GDBI, is a registered charity in Canada that helps pair Canadians who are blind or visually impaired with highly qualified guide dogs. For more than 50 years, Canadians have been matched with guide dogs from Guide Dogs for the Blind. GDBI receives no government funding and is supported entirely by private contributions. All donations will receive a charitable tax receipt. Learn more at gdbinternational.ca. From popularscience.com, popsci.com, parasitic birds like cuckoos seem to target victims who can't see well. Article by Kate Bagaley, B-A-G-G-A-L-E-Y, published September 29th. Common cuckoos aren't known for being model parents. Rather than raise their own young, they fob the task off on other birds. This strategy is used by approximately 100 species of cuckoos and other so-called brood parasites, but it doesn't always go according to plan. Sometimes the foster parents catch on. It turns out that which nests parasitic birds can successfully sneak their eggs into may partly depend on eye size, scientists reported this week. Researchers compared eyeball measurements from thousands of species of birds and found that parasitic birds tend to have larger eyes than the hosts that wind up raising their young. This could mean that the brood parasites, those that lay their eggs in other species' nests, are targeting birds whose eyesight isn't very keen. We now know that eyes reflect a history of brood parasitism, says Mark Hauber, H-A-U-B-E-R, a professor of animal behavior at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin. He and his co-author, Ian Osprey, A-U-S-P-R-E-Y, of the University of Florida in Gainesville, published the findings on September 28th in Biology Letters. Brood parasitism has evolved independently 7 times in various bird families that include cuckoos, songbirds, ducks, and honeyguides. In some species, the parasitic chick hatches first and pushes the host bird's eggs out of the nest, or even attacks and kills its foster siblings. Other times, the unwitting hosts are burdened with extra chicks to incubate and feed alongside their own offspring. Some birds are easier to deceive than others. When a host spies a spurious egg lurking in its nest, it will often grab or pierce the imposter with its beak and toss it out. Alternatively, Hauber says, yellow warblers sometimes build another story of the nest on top of the brown-headed cowbird eggs, preventing them from developing and hatching. We are super excited about being able to ask the big question, which is, if brood parasitism is costly, how do the brood parasites get away with it? Hauber says. And also, have the hosts responded to these costs with some sort of sensory adaptation, like changing the size of their eyes? To find out, he and Osprey drew upon a database of eyeball measurements taken from museum specimens. They examined 750 host birds, such as American robins, 42 brood parasites, such as common cuckoos, and 1,985 other species whose nests aren't parasitized, such as house sparrows. When analyzing the eye sizes, the pair took into account other reasons why birds might have evolved large eyes, such as owls need to hunt in the darkness. The researchers also consulted previously published experiments investigating how often different host species reject parasitic eggs. Hauber and Osprey saw that host birds have smaller eyes, both overall and relative to body size, than brood parasites. Host birds also tended to have smaller eyes than species that didn't fall victim to parasites. It makes sense for the parasite to go after birds that just naturally have a worse ability to detect odd-looking objects in the nest, Hauber says. Among host birds, species with large eyes were more likely than smaller-eyed birds to recognize parasitic eggs, so long as those imposters didn't too closely mimic their own eggs. Intriguingly, in a handful of species parasitized by cuckoos, the researchers observed that the cuckoo eggs most closely resembled belonging to hosts with large eyes. This suggests that the cuckoos and their victims share a long, intense history, Hauber says, with the parasite evolving to lay increasingly imitative eggs over time. The next step, Hauber says, is to investigate the vision-related areas of the avian brain to understand what underlies host birds' abilities to spot parasitic eggs. Eye size is likely more indicative of sharp eyesight than sophisticated color vision, he adds, so the size and pattern of the eggs are probably key clues. Despite showing a link between eye size and brood parasitism, the study doesn't actually mean that the eyes are the only ways by which host birds differentiate the importance of objects in their nest, such as foreign eggs laid by a brood parasite, Hauber says. From macfound.org, the MacArthur Foundation Fellows Program has nominated Joshua Miele, M-I-E-L-E, the Adaptive Technology Designer, Class of 2021. Developing devices to enable blind and visually impaired people to access everyday technologies and digital information. Joshua Miele is a blind adaptive technology designer developing devices to enable blind and visually impaired, BVI, people to use technologies that pervade our lives. Miele's graduate work focused on psychoacoustics, the science of sound perception, and directional aspects of hearing. More recently, he is creating effective and affordable solutions to everyday problems blind people face, particularly access to digital information. For example, tactile maps are difficult to find, often expensive, and available for only a limited number of locations. Miele developed Tactile Maps Automated Production, TMAP, a web-based software that generates tactile street maps of any location that can be printed with at-home Braille embossers. He designed a set of tactile maps for every station of the Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART, system, including platforms and street-level features, that is compatible with an audio smart pen, making it possible for blind travelers to virtually explore and plan their route through the BART system. Miele has also worked to make features on smartphones and portable devices more accessible to blind individuals. Wear a Braille has sensors attached to users' fingers to allow them to type Braille text without a special keyboard. Much of his recent work has focused on visual digital technologies, such as access to graphics and streaming video, that are often inaccessible to the VBI community. His YouDescribe platform combines crowdsourced audio descriptions of YouTube videos with an interface to synchronize the descriptive audio with the video source. Currently, Miela is an accessibility researcher at Amazon, where he has contributed to projects such as Braille compatibility with Fire tablets and a show-and-tell feature on camera-enabled Echo devices that can identify pantry and food items. Miela's expertise in information accessibility and commitment to making solutions available for mass use will be increasingly important as we move into an even more digitized world. Joshua Miela received a BA in 1992 and a PhD in 2003 from the University of California at Berkeley. From 2007 to 2019, he worked at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute as a principal investigator and as the associate director of research and development. Miela also served as the president of the board of directors for San Francisco's Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired from 2011 to 2015. Currently, he is a principal accessibility researcher at Amazon Lab 126. Miela's work has appeared in Perception, Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness, and British Journal of Visual Impairment, among other scientific journals, and in numerous conference proceedings, including those for the CHI Conference on Human Factors in Computing Systems and ACM Designing Interactive Systems Conference, among others. From AppleInsider.com, Apple removes Siri features used by visually impaired users. Article by Apple Insider staff posted September 30th. Apple device users who rely on the company's accessibility features are complaining about recent changes to Siri that remove commands for voice call, voicemail message, and email management. The most up-to-date versions of iOS 15 and iOS 14 no longer include Siri integrations for certain functions that were leveraged as accessibility shortcuts for visually impaired users. A total of 7 commands covering voice calls, call history, voicemails, and email creation that were previously available to Siri users are no longer legitimate queries in iOS 15 or iOS 14. Other commands might also be affected. The list of now removed commands querying Siri about call history lists the response, "I can't help with that, but you can ask me to open the phone app." Similar messages are provided for voicemail and email requests. It is unclear when or if Apple deprecated the Siri terms, but Mac Rumors, which reported the development on Wednesday, said it received multiple reports on the matter dating back at least 2 weeks. The change might have occurred when Apple was readying a public launch of iOS 15. Today's report notes that users can still access some data through Siri, including most recent calls and voicemails. It is not known if the removal can be traced back to a bug or is an intentional decision by Apple. Forum users on Apple Viz, a website that serves as a resource for blind and low vision users of Apple products, noted the removal of certain Siri commands earlier this month. One person contacted Apple support and was told that the company is aware of the email issue, suggesting a fix is incoming for that particular problem. Apple Insider has affiliate partnerships and may earn commission on products purchased through affiliate links. These partnerships do not influence our editorial content. From BleepingComputer.com, an article by Sergiu Gatlan, S-E-R-G-I-U-G-A-T-L-A-N. Emergency Google Chrome update fixes zero-day exploited in the wild. Google has released Chrome 94.0.4606.61 for Windows, Mac, and Linux, an emergency update addressing a high-severity zero-day vulnerability exploited in the wild. Google is aware that an exploit for CVE-2021-37973 exists in the wild, the browser vendor revealed in today's security advisory. This Chrome update has started rolling out worldwide to the stable desktop channel and will be available to all users over the following days and weeks. The update was available immediately when Bleeping Computer manually checked for new updates from the Chrome menu help about Google Chrome. The web browser will also check for new updates and automatically update itself after the next launch. Details regarding ongoing attacks not disclosed. The zero-day security flaw fixed today was reported the day the first Google Chrome 94 stable release was published, on September 21st, by Clément Lessigne from Google Tag, with assistance from Sergey Glazunov and Mark Brand from Google Project Zero. Those names are spelled C-L-E-Q-M-E-N-T-L-E-C-I-G-N-E, and Sergey is S-E-R-G-E-I-G-L-A-Z-U-N-O-A-V, and Mark Brand is M-A-R-K-B-R-A-N-D. The bug, tracked as CVE-2021-37973, is a use after free weakness in portals, Google's new web page navigation system for Chrome. Successful exploitation of this vulnerability can let attackers execute arbitrary code on computers running unpatched Chrome versions. Even though Google said it detected in the wild attacks abusing CVE-2021-37973, the company did not share additional info regarding these incidents. Access to bug details and links may be kept restricted until a majority of users are updated with a fix, Google said. We will also retain restrictions if the bug exists in a third-party library that other projects similarly depend on but haven't yet fixed. Chrome users should have enough time to install the security update to prevent exploitation attempts until more info is available. 11th zero-day fix this year. With this bug, Google has patched 11 zero-day vulnerabilities in the Chrome web browser since the start of 2021. Other Chrome zero-day bugs Google fixed this year are CVE-2021-21148 on February 4th, CVE-2021-21166, March 2nd, CVE-2021-21193, March 12th, CVE-2021-21220, April 13th, CVE-2021-21224, April 20th, CVE-2021-30551, June 9th, CVE-2021-30554, June 17th, CVE-2021-30563, July 15th, CVE-2021-30632 and 30633, September 13th. Because these security bugs are all known to have been abused by threat actors in the wild, installing all Google Chrome updates is strongly recommended as soon as they're available. Email from AFB, focus on AFB, Fall 2021 issue. During the American Foundation for the Blind's centennial year, we've been thinking a lot about what we want the world to look like 100 years from now. We want to see a world where children can dream big, where adults can pursue the careers of their choosing, and where older Americans can live safely and independently. In other words, we want a world where inclusion knows no limits. AFB is making history. Our future builds on our foundation of inclusion. AFB remains dedicated to our work of building a world of no limits, so we're celebrating our centennial all year long. Volunteer Corner. Researcher hones her skills while sharing them with AFB. With this issue, we're launching a periodic series highlighting volunteers who assist in AFB's work. Elizabeth Bolander has been a teacher of students with visual impairments, TVI, for 4 years and loves working with her students, but she began wondering if there was more she could do for students who are blind or visually impaired. That led her to pursue her doctorate and to volunteer as part of the research team at AFB. You can go to the AFB website to read more. I've ran out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to Vision News.